Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the show that reminds you no matter... Oh, he's laughing already. None of these guys want to be called heroes, but for the rest of us who weren't alive during World War II, their willingness to put their lives on the line for our country is certainly admirable. And the idea is, no matter where your hometown is in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small it might be, there are men and women around you who have done things you might not even imagine for the sake of our freedom. Today's show comes to you from Arroyo Grande, California, on the Central Coast, where folks have been listening to Hometown Heroes on 920 KVEC. Our guest today was a combat engineer in World War II, 92-year-old Vern Jackson. Not originally from California's coast, a much different climate in Madison, South Dakota. What's the coldest temperature you ever remember experiencing as a young boy?
38 degrees below zero. At that point, you bring in the mercury thermometers, they'll freeze. My dad was night watchman on the campus, and I follow him around the route at night lots of times, and I saw the thermometer say 38. I don't know why they did or not. I can lie a little, can't I?
Most of us, thankfully, have never experienced that. What does it feel like when it's 38 below?
When we got into the National Guard, we were very happy to get those heavy wool overcoats, wool pants, and wool shirts, because we had lots of cold weather. Not that cold, but once or twice. But what does it feel like? What? That temperature? Yeah. Oh, heck, I don't know. I've forgotten. It was cold.
Your memory of that froze, I suppose. Well, and we're going to get to some of your experiences in the war, some experiences not too many people can talk about in North Africa and in Italy as a combat engineer. But let's talk about how that started. You mentioned signing up for the National Guard, and you did this at a pretty young age. What was the idea behind that? How did that all come about?
The National Guard had summer camps, and the local company, Company A, Madison, was desirous of being full strength for the summer camp. The captain came to the campus, or to the high school, wanted people, guys, to sign up. Well, he said, if you aren't quite 18, just say you are, there'll be no problem. Some buddies of mine that knew I needed to be come a little more world-wise, I guess, talked me into signing up. And so I lied away a year of my life to get in the National Guard. A couple weeks later, we were on our way to Rapid City, South Dakota, where Camp Rapid was, and spent 2 weeks there. And that was my introduction into military service. It was sort of military, National Guard.
To put it in perspective for folks, this is long before America entered World War II. You're talking about 1938?
39. I had turned 18 about 2 weeks after I told him I was already 18.
So it wasn't that big of a lie, only a couple weeks.
That's right. I'm not a big liar, just a small liar.
That's what we all say, right? So you're in the National Guard, and things are changing all around you. When did you realize that this might be more of a long-term thing for you, not just something to go and camp and get a cool wool parka?
The beginning, there was no worry of war, I don't think. The second camp, a year later, was in Camp Ripley, Minnesota, north of Minneapolis a ways. We may have had some sense of it. It was beginning, we're beginning to think about it. But that fall, it became much more real. It wasn't too long, and they talked about mobilizing us for a year of federal training, National Guard. Somebody was thinking, well, Franklin D. was thinking ahead, I think. Yeah. I say again and again, your sons will never fight on foreign soil. Yeah, well, they were already building bases over in Ireland, and I found that out.
So this is still, again, before Pearl Harbor, but you end up in what you expect to be a year in the military, and it's during this time that the attack on Pearl Harbor happens. Where were you on December 7th?
I was in the company street in front of the supply tent where I had been printing pictures that night. I don't know who brought the news to me, but they did. Pearl Harbor has been bombed, and that was a bit of a shock, a bit of a shock. Then we knew this is war. We knew it immediately, and it was just no time at all, and we were making preparations to move out. We'd had 11 months of our year. There was nothing to stop us. We didn't know where we were going to be going, but within 2 weeks, we were aboard a train. I had the detail that guarded the equipment train. The rest of the battalion, I guess, they had left earlier by train and were going east. None of us knew where we were going, but we were going east and into cold weather. because Louisiana hadn't been anything. It was very nice down there. I liked Louisiana.
And that's where you were on December 7th, was Camp Claiborne?
Yes.
So I guess I should ask you also, you're in this National Guard and you're activated for a year of federal service with war drums banging, and now there is a war. How did it happen that you became a combat engineer? Is that something you volunteered for? Is that something the Army said, you know what, he'd be good at this? How did that happen?
34th Red Bull Infantry Division has, at the time, I think it was six companies of engineers, combat engineers, which were assigned to support the infantry. Doesn't really mean engineer. Well, it does, because you build bridges and roads and put together Bailey bridges. You do all the dirty work, the shovels and picks.
Take apart mines, find mines, see your friends blown up by mines. Pretty dangerous duty. I don't want you to understate it here.
Well, the dangerous part, we had to learn about them when we were in Ireland for 6-8 months. We got some general idea that the British tried to give us of German equipment, but it wasn't until we got to Africa and found mines and took them apart and played with them and put them back together, maybe. Well, mines are a special thing. They have a hole in them in which screws a detonator, and then there's maybe a trip wire, or maybe it's, if they're tank mines, the top of them squashes and detonates them. Well, we had to learn all these things. We had to learn about S mines, the one that jumps out of the ground about, well, randomly originally. Eventually they put a wire on them so they would go up about 6 feet and blow up. But originally they'd go up random. We lost a couple of guys just trying to learn what goes into a S mine, what they do.
And that begs the question, what did that do to you? I mean, what's your mindset when you see stuff like that? You see your friends getting blown up, or guys that you know. Doesn't it occur to you that you're doing something pretty dangerous, that you might not be around tomorrow?
Yeah. One of the things we got to do was run mine schools for the infantry. We didn't piddle around. We used live explosives, and we lost several guys. I was supposed to be one of them, but I've lucked out.
Well, I think everyone hears you say that and says, okay, there's a story there, so tell us that story.
Oh, my. It kind of spoils the threat. Three of us had transferred from the line company into headquarters company. It's just over the last 8 months of the war, before the end of the war. One, Joe Pauly, was a camouflage expert. Fred Buckmeyer was a demolitions expert, and he was too. He designed some things. And I was the chemical warfare type. That's not what we did in headquarters company, however, we ran mine schools. Fortunately, this particular time when there was an explosion that killed a couple of guys and I think neutralized Fred, because he was right by the truck, but protected by the body of the back of the dump truck, so he didn't get too many shrapnel pieces in him, but he got some. We had a pass to Rome. We were in a rest area for this training, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. So instead of being with the outfit, we were off to Rome. However, that did happen on Monday, first day of the school. We could have been there, but we just weren't. That was a kind of a minor thing. It was just the supplies in the back of the truck that we were running the school with. But we had a roll of Primacord, detonators, and some TNT in the back there. It all blew up kind of hard on two guys. One fellow, there was an infantryman, 100th Battalion man, sitting on an open-air John, 50 yards away or so, and a piece of shrapnel got him, killed him, as well as a couple of our guys. But Joe and I lucked out. We were not going to be, we were excused for the whole week, happily.
So I know this isn't the nowhere near the only close call that you had during the service, but basically you and your friend were excused for the week, and one of your buddies and some other people, a couple of them killed and others wounded because of something that could have happened at any point. Just all this explosive material went up?
Have no idea what might have done it. No idea. I wouldn't even guess now, but there was something, and there were items there that concussion or slight, not just jolting, but you'd pinch them, would be the main thing. If there was one cap or something under a box, and the box got shifted, it would start what could be a building up of from the little fire to an enormous one. I don't mean to say fire, explosion is what I really mean.
I know we're going to hear about some of the more than 300 days you spent in combat, but even some of the days where you weren't in combat, you're around explosive material all the time. How did you approach that? Because I think a lot of guys would have been scared out of their minds. You don't seem to be too bent out of shape about it. How did you deal with that ever present?
We took it apart to learn about it. We I guess we had some idea of dying when we went overseas, and so it was always a background item. But you didn't think about it until the time you get shot at. Now, then you would begin to say, "Is this the time?"
Did you think you were going to come home from the war?
Yes, I hope so.
Why? What gave you that assurance?
At the time, I had no faith, Christian faith. I wasn't depending on the Lord for protection. I feel fully that He was watching me from day one, though, from birth on up, because I've lived a long time and I've had a lot of experiences where I could have got killed. But I had a good friend there in the service, this man, Walter Burkett, who is a strong, very strong Christian, and he tried to convert me, shall we say. I said, by golly, if I could live through this and get home, I'm going to rewrite that Bible. I'm going to take out the blood and the lamb and the silly stuff, which is so terrible to think of, even almost. Somebody else beat me to it. I better not name him.
Well, I think that's interesting to hear you put it that way, that you have a faith now, an understanding of what was happening then that you couldn't grasp at the time. And let's fill in some of those details there about some of the intense experiences you had. I've interviewed quite a few guys that were in North Africa, but they're getting harder and harder to find. So many of the veterans that are still around were maybe in Europe or maybe in the Pacific, but North Africa happened so early and didn't last as long as those other areas. Do you ever find people when you tell them that you served in North Africa that they weren't even aware that the U.S. was in North Africa during the war? Have you ever gotten some surprised reactions?
There's a lot of young people that have no concept of anything back that far, but I'm surprised at how many students of World War II there are around. I mean, young people, I've got a good friend in the church that he's bent on learning about that time. It's interesting to him, and there's quite a few people in that category.
Well, and I want to hit on the things that you think are important for those of us who weren't there to understand about it. What was it like for a boy from South Dakota to land in North Africa and then find himself witnessing some pretty intense battles between American forces and Rommel and the Germans?
Well, fortunately, I was, as a combat engineer, not front line. We bivouacked back somewhere, spent our days. At night, we'd go forward, lay barbed wire, lift mines, lay mines, build roads. If we could do it in the daytime, we would, but much of it was done at night.
And you talk about building roads, and I imagine most of us don't know how you would go about building a road in the desert that tanks and convoys are going to have to use.
Maybe you clear a hole through a cactus patch by chopping down cactus. Then they have what we called wadis, creeks, and there'd be water in the bottom of them, and they'd probably 200 feet across and 8 foot deep. And then in the bottom of it was the creek, was the wadi. So you get your bulldozer in there, and you get knocked down the wall, so you get down to that water level, and I don't remember what we did, so you get actually through the water, depending on size of it, of course. But we had culverts available, we had Bailey bridges, that's for big things. Bailey bridges are all over the place, incidentally. I've found them here in San Luis Obispo. When it first came, there was a bridge street. And on Bridge Street was an outfit that manufactured Bailey bridge segments. They were, 12 feet long, 4 foot high, went together like tinker toys, you might say. And they had big piles of them. Very recently, they had a road failure, and they got some Bailey bridge parts and built a... This is within the last 4 years. That's up by the Cal Poly. That was there for a year or so while they redid the road under it. I found them in Canada. I found them in various places in the United States. And among the places where I found them, we were in Israel. From Jordan over to Israel, a Bailey Bridge.
Well, if folks have seen the movie A Bridge Too Far, they know what you're talking about. There were thousands of those modular prefabricated bridges built by engineers in World War II. And all the engineers I've talked to have said it was a pretty simple process.
You build a section of it on the ground. You push it out until it teeters. And then you build another. Eventually, it'll teeter down on the other side. So somebody over there better be building an abutment for you.
So building bridges was part of what you did as a combat engineer, but there was quite a bit more, and we're going to discuss that when we come back. 92-year-old Vernon Jackson of Arroyo Grande is our guest. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Our World War II veterans deserve a chance to see their memorial in Washington, D.C., and you can help send them there simply by renting a car. Between now and the end of October, visit any Enterprise Rent-A-Car location from Bakersfield in the south to Tulare, Visalia, Hanford, Selma, Fresno, Madera, Merced, all the way north to Sacramento. Tell them you heard this ad on Hometown Heroes, and Enterprise will donate 10% of your rental to Central Valley Honor Flight. Restrictions may apply. I'm sure you're familiar with Enterprise, but do you know why the largest car rental company in the U.S. is called Enterprise? The company's founder, Jack Taylor, was a decorated F-6F Hellcat pilot in World War II, flying off the deck of the Big E, the aircraft carrier USS Enterprise. Maybe I should get him on the show sometime and he can tell us how he earned the Distinguished Flying Cross. In the meantime, choose Enterprise for your next rental. Tell him you heard this advertisement on Hometown Heroes, and you'll be helping to send our World War II veterans on one more tour with honor.